Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio. Well, today it's the chocolate story you never hear. Chocolate expert Maricel Persia explains how Latin peoples figured out that chocolate could come from the white, slimy insides of the cacao pod. And she's got the next big thing for chocolate lovers. We've a Maverick's take on California's new Italian grape craze from winemaker Randall Graham. Cheese expert Steve Jenkins says Brie is dead, but long live its rivals. We go to New Orleans for the return of a Sunday classic, Breaking Fast with Rice Cala. Then celebrity, salsa, literacy, and Mexican farm women meet in an adult ed class. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's open with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. So Jane, Michael, what have you been up to?
Lynn, we've been at the East Branch of the Delaware River in upstate New York, where we met Ray Turner, known as the Eel Man because of what he smokes and sells at his little smokehouse. I personally love eel. Jane, on the other hand, has a few problems with it.
Are these the big black eels that look like snakes with a tail fin on them?
Well, the snake scenario is something that everyone has as a cross to bear, because you're not afraid of snakes until somebody teaches you to be afraid of snakes, and then it matriculates more or less to the eel because of their shape. They're just a long, thin fish, but the truth of the matter is that they're a very, very high quality protein that should be observed, as opposed to their shape and giving you a bad opinion of them. They're just a really good type of food.
I think I really insulted Ray Turner, the eel man, when I asked him that question. In fact, he said something about the ick factor, which is, I guess a lot of people have problems with the idea of eating an eel because it is icky.
It is not icky. It's delicious. It's got maximum amount of flavor, and it's especially good. I don't know. I'm sure there are other ways to prepare it, but the way Ray Turner does it is to smoke it and over applewood, after brining it with salt and this really wonderful, extremely flavorful dark honey that he uses. So it's got a kind of sweetness to it. I mean, it's hard to describe. It's like no other food I've ever eaten.
He traps all his own eels every autumn in what's called a weir, W-E-I-R, which I think is what an eel trap is called.
Uh-huh.
He said they vary in size, you know, according to the season. Some of them are enormous, and then they get to be little guys. And, I mean,
he traps as many as he can. Cut it out.
Sorry.
The good news for people like Jane who are unadventurous is that he smokes other things as well. You can get trout, you can get salmon, duckling, Cornish hen. We got a huge slab of bacon that lasted us about a month when we were there.
Oh,
and some shrimp, too, these gigantic shrimp that he had smoked, which were all wonderful. But, I mean, this is an eel place, and I know this because it's way, way, way off of Route 17 in New York State. And there's a teeny little sign by the side of the road that it's a hand-painted sign way up in a tree, and it says E-E-L. With an arrow. You follow the sign, you go maybe a mile into the woods, there's another sign that says EEL on a branch of the road, and you keep following the EEL signs until you get to this smokehouse surrounded by nothing but trees and the Delaware River.
Just getting there sounds like it's half the fun, but can you mail order? I mean, do we all have to follow the eel signs? Is there any other way to get his stuff?
As a matter of fact, I am glad you asked, because Ray Turner does, remote as he may be, he is able to ship this stuff via UPS, and he usually has a good supply of eel starting in the fall, going through maybe the spring, by which time he runs out. The other things, you know, the Cornish hens, the duckling, the salmon, mm-hmm. he has year-round. The eel is available from fall into spring, and he will mail order it to you from his smokehouse in Hancock, New York.
All right, I got a quick question, Michael.
Yeah.
Does it taste like chicken?
Not the least bit like chicken.
It sure doesn't look like chicken.
You know, it's a good thing there are two of you. Thank you, guys.
Happy travels. Hey, let me squeal, let me squeal. Squeal just like an eel. Squeal, let me squeal. Squeal just like an eel. You know how you love it. You know how you make me feel.
Okay, I can see it. Your nose is wrinkled up at the thought of eating eel. Let's face it, they're a hard sell. You know, it's the snake thing. But they're fascinating. You know, we've talked about this before, but it's really worth repeating. Now, here's the deal. Scientists think, they're still not sure, that eels in Europe and America come from the Sargasso Sea. It's way out in the Atlantic, kind of east of Florida. But all eels grow up in fresh water, like your local river, for instance. And eels can live up to 36 hours outside of the water. They've actually been known to travel for miles to get to a new stream or a river. And there's one other thing. The first food that a young eel tastes when it arrives in fresh water, that's going to be its food of choice for life. And when it comes to eating eel, well, for my money, the Japanese do just about the best entry-level eel. Order unagi in a Japanese restaurant. Now, this is cooked eel that's basted with this sweet mirin wine and soy sauce as it's browning on the grill. You eat it over rice. And no, it doesn't taste like chicken. Anyway, I think you know, you can get all of Jane and Michael's finds on the website, splendidtable.org. Winemaker Randall Graham created California's Bonnie Doone Vineyards with a mission in mind. He believes California is the ideal climate for Southern European grapes, but not for cabs and Chardonnays. And he always has some interesting opinions to share. Randall, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So, Randall, rumor has it that you're fooling around with Italian grapes.
I'm fooling around with Italian grapes in every way, shape, and form. I love France. I'm a Francophile. But once you go to Italy and start spending time in Italy, Italy is quite compelling. So we're making wine in California under the Cadel Solo label, which is sort of our rendition of traditional Italian grape varieties. And then we're also doing some collaborative projects in Italy, working with Italian winemakers.
So what are you making?
Well, in California, I'm working with Sangiovese, Barbera, Malvasia, Moscato, and a lot of other varieties too numerous to mention.
Uh-huh.
And then in Italy, I'm doing a project in the Marche and one in Puglia.
Which is, Marche is central Italy and Puglia is way down. It's the heel of the boot.
Right, on the
yeah.
Adriatic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now, wines from Puglia, there aren't a lot of wines we see in the United States from Puglia. What are you doing from Puglia?
Puglia is kind of one of these third world viticultural areas. It's not really well regarded, at least not in Italy, but it's capable of making sublime, sublime wines. The wines that people know of are Salice Salentino and Primitivo, mm-hmm. but there's a very obscure grape there called Uva di Troia, which I adore, and it's so elegant and intelligent and wonderful.
It's a red grape?
It's a red grape. It ripens very late. It's grown on tendone, which are overhead trellises, so to protect it from the sun. And it smells like violets. It has the most wonderfully enchanting aroma of violets.
Ooh. Uva di Troia. Does that mean the grape of Troy?
That's what I thought at first, but I was enlightened. It actually means grape of the prostitute. And
It's got to be local dialect.
It's a
right?
Yeah. I don't know why it's called grape of the or grape of the trollop, if you will. Possibly it's the very intoxicating perfume that gave them that idea to give it the name.
So, okay, we know a lot of people are working with Sangiovese and Barbera. I mean, we can see that on a lot of labels. But I ran across one of your bottles that really intrigued me. It's this sort of, some people would call it a soda pop wine.
Yes.
And I've never seen it in the United States before. It's called Fresa.
Right.
And it comes from way up in the Piedmont where Barolo comes from. Why this wine?
Well, I love ugly duckling grapes. I love obscure grapes. And Freisa is about as obscure as it gets. Freisa in Piemontese dialect is strawberry. And Freisa, the grape, has this wonderful fragrance of strawberries. What's interesting about this grape is that it was discovered by Professor Hilgard over 100 years ago at the University of California. He imported it into California, and he wanted every single grape grower to plant Freisa. So he sent a memo to all the county agents advising their farmers to grow Freisa. And of course, nobody grew any Freisa. It's been in the University of California collection for over 100 years. I found it there, made some cuttings, propagated it, and am growing it. And what's interesting is I think that the Freisa we have in California is an antique clone that may be more interesting than the Freisa that's currently grown in Piemonte.
All right, you have to describe what this wine is like.
This is kind of soda pop for grown-ups. It's a lurid pink color. It's low in alcohol. It's about 5.5% alcohol. You open it up, and it smells like strawberries. It's just uncanny. You taste it. It's very crisp. It has good acidity. So even though it's sweet, it's not cloyingly sweet. It's very refreshing. It's very meditative. It's very calming and soothing.
All right. Now, it comes from a place, the Piedmont, way up in northern Italy, is famous for very fancy wines.
Yes.
How is Freisa drunk there?
Well, what I love so much about Italians is the fact that they're so particular about their wine and food pairings. Freisa is made in three different styles in Piemonte. One is a dry red table wine, which is fairly harsh and undrinkable. Secondly, it's made in this fizzy, low alcohol, delightful, enchanting style, which I think is great. And the last way they make it is they make it as a dry wine, leaving residual carbon dioxide in it. And they particularly like this with their local salami. And I think it's so fantastic that a wine is made specifically to complement one particular dish and one dish only. I think that's fantastic.
Thank you, Randall.
It's my pleasure.
Winemaker Randall Graham is founder of Bonnie Doon Vineyards. You can get information on the wines he talked about on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, have a listen to Tuesday Night Kitchen. It's our show heard only on the web. We designed it to help make your weeknight kitchen forays a little easier. It's full of cooking ideas, new things to try, and conversations with you. So check it out at splendidtable.org. Coming up, a new holy grail for chocolate lovers and the end of the brie craze, as well as open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. You know, we may love chocolate, but consider this. Most of us haven't a clue about where it comes from or what it takes to produce it. It's not like wine or cheese. And trust me, if you saw a cacao pod, I'd bet you that you'd never think anything edible could come from it. Which brings me to an unusual book. It's called The New Taste of Chocolate, A Cultural and Natural History of Cacao with Recipes. It's by Maricel Prisia, and Maricel has a PhD in medieval history. She's trained in culinary anthropology, she runs her own restaurant, and she consults on chocolate around the world. Maricel, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am good. Maricel, this is what puzzles me. If you see a picture of a cacao pod, it looks like a lumpy, ugly squash. And if you see it cut, there's all this white, slimy stuff inside. How did anybody ever look at that and end up figuring out how to make chocolate from it?
That's a very good question. Because when you cut open a cacao pod, you find that it is a tropical fruit and not a box of Hershey Kisses. Each pod encloses from 20 to 40 beans, which are attached to a placenta, and they're encapsulated in a sticky white pulp. There is nothing about the color, the smell, and the flavor of the pulp or the beans that even faintly resembles chocolate. Actually, the pulp is tart and delicious, and it reminds me always of lychees, which I adore, mm-hmm. and the beans are bitter and astringent. So it is really quite extraordinary to hear that the Maya were already drinking chocolate 2,600 years ago. I don't know if you've heard about the latest discoveries, but very recently, a team of archaeologists from the University of Texas at Austin found a spouted pot containing residues of chocolate at a Maya burial site in northern Belize dating to 600 to 400 BC, which is extraordinary.
Huh. So how did they come to make the chocolate from this? Do you have any theories?
Actually, the first people to see past the pulp, which was probably used to make refreshing drinks all over tropical America, and to concentrate on the beans, which is the source of chocolate, were the Olmecs of the Gulf Coast of Mexico that flourished around 1500 BC. Now, I don't see the leap from fruit to chocolate as anything miraculous. The Olmecs probably treated cacao in the same systematic way that they and other pre-Columbian peoples elsewhere treated other fruit plants, including corn. So following what I call the law of maximum use, they tried to get as much of the plant of cacao with its enormous fruits full of seeds as they could. You know, raw, the beans were bitter and astringent. So I assume that they spread them on clay griddles to roast them, discovering that they became quite edible in the process. Then they proceeded to grind them on stone slabs. And these, Lynn, were the same everyday techniques they used to treat other foods such as chiles, pumpkin, seeds, and corn. Now, what is remarkable to me is that every single step they took, from collecting and opening the fruit, from heaping the beans, probably under the sun, to wait for the pulp to soften and melt by itself so they could roast them on a low fire, brought the bitter and astringent cacao beans closer to chocolate. The interior of the beans fermented to some degree in the sun, creating a number of chemical compounds we call chocolate flavor precursors today. Mm-hmm. Grinding the roasted seeds released their oils and other volatile substances. In the end, the whole process created a fragrant paste that could be shaped into cakes or balls. In other words, what we have here is that pre-Columbian people succeeded in creating chocolate, but the steps they followed to make their drinking chocolate were, in essence, the same farmers and manufacturers follow today to make chocolate for both drinking and baking. And this is quite remarkable.
Maricel, for people like you, for chocolate experts, are there any holy grails of cacao beans?
Absolutely. There is a type of cacao called porcelana, which is considered to be the finest of all cacaos. It is extraordinary. And it grows in the flat, humid lands south of Lake Maracaibo. I was able to go to the experimental plantation to see this cacao close because I had never seen it before. I had heard about it. And it's as extraordinary as the sources tell us. The flavor is intense. It's the chocolate flavor lingers, and there is not a trace of astringency or bitterness or acidity. The aroma was stronger than the aroma of any other chocolate I had ever tasted.
So is there any chocolate made from the porcelana bean available here in the United States?
There are chocolates made with a blend of beans from the South Maracaibo area that incorporate porcelana. And there is a firm, an Italian firm called Domori, that is already selling chocolate with Porcelana. Guittard, an American company based in San Francisco, sells a chocolate called Sur del Lago that has a high percentage of Porcelana beans. Scharfenberger has come out with a bar with a blend of Porcelana beans and Ghana beans, mm-hmm. which is really delicious. And I think in a couple of years, or maybe less, Valrhona will launch a chocolate made with 100% Porcelana beans because they do have a farm in that area.
Uh-huh. Well, Maricel, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Maricel Priscia is author of The New Taste of Chocolate, A Cultural and Natural History of Cacao with Recipes. Now, you can find sources for the Porcelana chocolates on the website. And Maricel left us with two recipes, one for cacao chili balls. Now, this is a seasoning from Guatemala that hasn't changed since the days of the Mayans. And also, she's got a recipe for chocolate rice pudding. Find them all on the website, splendidtable.org. Cheese authority Steve Jenkins is a pioneer. He started hunting down artisan cheeses 25 years ago, before it was a big craze. He's the author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer. Hey, Steve, welcome back.
Hi, Liam. Great to be here.
Steve, I want to talk to you today about Brie.
Brie is a specific region east of Paris that is known for a great, very creamy, oozy, blonde cheese that, if it comes from the Brie region and is made by people rather than by machines, ranks as one of the great, great cheeses of the world. But unfortunately, this is the year 2002, and that's not what we're getting here in the United States.
So what are we getting?
We're getting factory cheese that's made from dead milk that only resembles Brie visually. It has none of the flavor and none of the integrity and none of the hands-on attention that real Brie requires for it to be the great, great cheese that it is. When you pasteurize milk, you kill all the flavor molecules in the milk. You're never going to come up with a good cheese when you make it from pasteurized milk. Secondly, when you make so much of it, and I mean literally megatons of it, as is the Brie industry, you're not going to have a cheese that's worth talking about and certainly is not memorable. The cheese that we get that's referred to as Brie may be made in France, may be made in Wisconsin, never saw the Brie region east of Paris, and has no resemblance whatsoever to the real McCoy.
So are there cheeses that meet your criteria that are similar to Brie? A good Brie.
Not only meet my criterion, but are the ones that I take home to share with my best friends constantly. There's nothing like serious raw milk, soft, ripened cheese.
Uh-huh.
Camembert is the exact same recipe as Brie. But here in the United States, we have access to magnificent Camembert. Why? Because there's a couple of companies that know how to put the flavor molecules back into the pasteurized milk in order to give it the flavor that raw milk Camemberts would give us. And specifically, if you look for brands like Le Chatelain, C-H-A-T-E-L-A-I-N, or the Isigny Camemberts that come from Normandy, mm-hmm. I-S-I-G-N-Y, you're going to have the most magnificent cheese experience that you've ever, ever had. Real Brie, real Camembert tastes like wild mushrooms that are sautéed in garlic and butter. They taste like fried eggs. They taste like white truffles. They taste like very rare grilled beef. There's really nothing quite like soft, ripened cheese that's made from milk that hasn't been cauterized out of existence.
Is there anything else other than Camembert that you can
absolutely
suggest?
Chaurs, C-H-A-O-U-R-C-E, which is a village in Champagne, in France, has for centuries made a cheese that's slightly richer than Brie, named after the village, Chaurs, slightly taller, about twice as thick as Brie or Camembert. But a brilliant cheese with a bit of a chalky interior, but runny, oozy all around the outside, all the way to the floury crust that we refer to as croûte fleurie. That's a great choice. In Piemonte, the tuma della paja, paja meaning straw, because this is a tuma, a toma that is ripened having been thrust inside bales of hay, and then the weight and the heat that's from the weight of the hay ripens the cheese. Tuma de la Paja from Piemonte is one of the great, great soft ripened cheeses. Reblochon from Savoie is one of the five greatest cheeses in the world.
Steve, you not only made your point, but this is a whole new collection to try. Hey, thanks.
Pleasure.
Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. You can find Steve behind the counter at Fairway Markets in New York City, but you can find his cheese picks on our website, splendidtable.org. New Orleans is one of those places with a palpable aura of mystery. You walk the streets on a quiet night, and the past is right there. It's almost in your hands. Whether it's Anne Rice's vampires or the phenomenal food heritage, every time you turn around, there's another tradition to learn about.
On a Sunday in Jackson Square, the heart of the French Quarter in New Orleans, the bells of St. Louis Cathedral signal the end of Mass. For many, it's time to eat. Families spill into restaurants like Galatoire's, Antoine's, and Brennan's, where Sunday meals are as much a tradition as Mass itself. But older generations remember another tradition, one which, until recently, nearly disappeared. Rice challah. Challah is a kind of fritter or donut, a close cousin to the beignet, that enduring local favorite that draws so many to Café du Monde in the French Market. Only challah is made with cooked rice, giving it a mealier, heavier texture, a slightly richer flavor. And it also has a history as distinct and creolized as New Orleans itself. 19th century African-American women, both slaves and free women of color, would stake their spots outside St. Louis Cathedral with trays of hot rice challah, waiting for the bells to ring.
Belle challah, madame, belle challah, moi garantie vous y est bon, belle challah, belle challah. I have challah, I have rice fritters, I guarantee you that they are good.
That's Jessica Harris, a food historian who has studied challah from its origins in West Africa to its incarnations in the New World, mainly through the slave trade.
There is a whole kind of tradition, if you will, of huckstering and selling things in Western Africa, from which many people were sent to New Orleans. That's one of the ways it got here.
And then there were the unique circumstances that enabled the challah vendors to thrive, mainly the staunch Creole Catholic belief that you do not eat before communion.
Because you don't eat before you take communion. When you come out of church, you might be a little, as we say, peckish. And so it became what one did as one exited the cathedral.
Add to that the fact that many Creole Catholics in the city gave their slaves Sundays off, and this was a chance for those slaves to make a little money of their own.
Just the thought that there are enslaved Africans who have a kind of liberty to engage in any kind of activity other than, you know, plantation field work to prepare any kind of food and sell it is still a concept that some people have trouble with. And in that sense, there were people who were able to buy their own freedom from that pittance.
The challah vendors slowly trickled away from Jackson Square, and by World War II, rice challah had all but disappeared from the streets of New Orleans. But some of the city's biggest chefs are taking an interest in reviving the dish. One of them is Susan Spicer, who serves rice challah as a brunch special from her kitchen at Cobalt, where she recently prepared some.
For a basic recipe, I would say about 1.5 cups of cooked rice, half a package of dry yeast with 1/2 cup of warm water, and then you add in 3 eggs, 1¼ cups of all-purpose flour, about 1/4 cup of sugar. You don't have to put a lot of sugar in at that point because generally they're served with powdered sugar on top of them. So I take the rice, mash it up, add the yeast and water. Then we leave it out all night. And then otherwise we try to do it first thing in the morning so that it has a little time to sit. And then you mix in your flour, sugar, salt, and a little bit of nutmeg. And then a little more water and eggs. And then you let that rise again. And it should rise for about 30 minutes or so. And then the third part is the frying. You can just drop it by spoonfuls. Generally, they will rise to the surface as they cook. And you want to probably cook them for, you know, at least a couple of minutes after they come to the surface. The underside will be kind of nice and golden brown, but then you have to turn them one time.
She spoons the calaf in the hot oil, letting them cool on paper towels and dusting them with powdered sugar.
You can see the individual kernels of rice in there, interspersed. It's cooked on the inside. That's the main thing you want to see. I think they're very nice with sort of a fruit sauce or a fruit jam in addition to the sugar. My version of Creole rice challah.
And that's a tasty piece of reclaimed history from the 19th century West African vendors in Jackson Square to a chef's brunch table in 21st century New Orleans.
Michael Depp is a writer living in New Orleans. This little blue book landed on my desk this week. It's called Secrets of Salsa, a bilingual cookbook by the Mexican women of Anderson Valley. Now, the women are studying English at Anderson Valley's adult school. Their lunchtime habit of bringing in salsas from home took on a life of its own that no one could have imagined. To get the story, we have teacher Barbara Goodell on the phone. Barbara, welcome to the Splendid Table.
Thank you.
So Barbara, how did the book come into being?
Well, it was in English classes in Anderson Valley, and we have a lot of new wineries here, so that there's a large Mexican population. And this was in the morning class where the women are coming and learning English. And we were finding that 3 hours was a long time without food. So we started sharing, bringing the food. And each day when the women would bring the food, an absolutely incredible salsa would come with it, with an array of colors and tastes and flavors. And we were so impressed with it that we decided that for a small fundraiser, we would put the recipes together and make a cookbook.
Aha. So everybody had to write up their recipe. Was that sort of part of the lesson in learning English?
It was, and it actually turned out to be a rather larger lesson than we expected, because none of these recipes were written down in any language before, and an English-speaking person would work directly with the author of the recipe and try to make it there and see if it really worked before we produced the book.
What a great way to get people from different backgrounds together.
It was. Yeah. The whole project has been an incredible community event.
You said it was a fundraiser. Where does the money go?
It goes to, actually, to the adult school, because we can't make enough money to support the amount of teachers and the good program that we have here. But also, about $10,000 of it was donated by a winery to a separate group, which is called Pura Salsa, and that is to help the women. And maybe somebody has a larger hospital bill than they can handle, or we're talking about doing a salsa business, this might be able to be a loan. And we also had a big celebration dinner with it, where the women were honored last Mother's Day, which was really quite an event. So the women sit on a steering committee with other local English speakers and decide how to use the money. But most of it goes to the adult school.
Well, Barbara, thank you very much.
Well, you're quite welcome. And if anybody would like to order the book, they can look at our website at www.secretsofsalsa.com.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
Barbara Goodell teaches the Mexican women at the Anderson Valley Adult School. Their book is Secrets of Salsa, a bilingual cookbook. It's a gem. The recipes are dynamite. Now, I've chosen one for the website that I think is just a new take on salsa. It's potato and carrot salsa, and you can find it at splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge, and it was inspired by Maricel Persia's book on chocolate. Here's the question. It's about a type of cocoa that's called for in a lot of recipes. The question is, what in heaven's name is Dutch process cocoa? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. We're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. That number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was about a kind of cocoa that's called for in a lot of recipes. The question is, what in heaven's name is Dutch process cocoa? Well, Dutch process is treating cocoa with alkali to reduce its acidity and darken its color. Now, a lot of baking experts claim that this makes for a higher quality cocoa. It's mellower than regular cocoa. But chocolate authority Maricel Persia claims that just the opposite is true. She talks about this in her new book, The New Taste of Chocolate. She says the alkali treatment is really used to offset the natural acidity of it's created in Holland in 1828 by Conrad van Houten. Now, for we cooks, the important thing to remember is that Dutch processed cocoa has a milder flavor than other kinds of cocoa. So if you want a big chocolate taste, go for non-Dutch processed. And they're probably made from better beans, too. By the way, there's one last trivia gem from Maricel that I can't resist. You know how solid chocolate can melt so slowly and sensuously on your tongue? Well, that isn't your imagination. Cocoa butter, the fatty part of the chocolate, is incredibly complex. It's actually three different fatty acids, and they form three different fats, and they each melt at three different temperatures, hence that luxurious melt that is like nothing on earth. We are opening the lines for your calls at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Let's get right to it. We've got Michael on the line. So, Michael, what do you want to talk about?
You know, Lynn, I'd like to talk to you about cooking with some beers.
Oh.
There was a fellow on your show about a month ago or so that was talking about European beers, etc.
Steve Beaumont. He's our beer guy. Yeah.
Oh, great. Well, yeah. He probably knows a lot more about the actual beers than I do, but I cook with beer frequently. And I have found that you can make some wonderful gravies and dipping sauces if you reduce the sauces that you use after you cook the meat in the and vegetables, if you decide to put root vegetables in there or something.
Yeah.
In the sauce, okay. And I started doing this about, oh, maybe 2 years ago. And I live in the Pacific Northwest where we have lots of local beers.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that using stout beers, India Pale Ales, and bitters are the best that you can come up with. I marinate the meat in the beer for like 24 hours or so.
Yeah.
And I put ginger and garlic and cayenne pepper and, oh, cilantro, whatever I have at the store. I live in a small town, so I'm sort of at the end of the food chain.
These beers are pretty distinctive tasting beers. So you're marinating them in the beers, and then you cook them in the beer, right?
That's correct.
Uh-huh. And then you reduce down those juices to make like a sauce.
That's exactly right. And the key is that when you add the beer to the hot pan, it's going to foam up.
Right, right.
So you sort of have to stir that around and add a little bit of water at a time.
Right. Right.
Then you can just simmer it.
You know what's interesting is you're doing exactly the same thing you would do with wine. But the beer, in some ways, presents even a greater variety of flavors. You know, Belgian recipes, if you want to find some old recipes, classic ones for beer cookery, the Belgians have this broad range of beers, and there are some wonderful dishes. But this sounds great. It's the kind of thing all of us can try.
Oh, absolutely. And I can tell you from doing that also, if sometimes when you're cooking with it, it's a little tricky. And if the taste doesn't seem right,
yeah,
sweeten it a little bit.
Yeah, because beer can have that bitter edge to it. So add a little brown sugar or something like that.
Add a little brown sugar or maple syrup or whatever you have around your house.
Michael, you have given us a whole new way of approaching dealing with beer. We can drink it, but let's do more cooking with it.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks a lot. And have a great...
Thank you for having me on your show.
You're welcome.
All right,
thank
bye-bye.
You. Goodbye. I think this is a great contribution to all of us. And I love the idea that he's using, you know, ginger and he's using coriander and he's using chilies. Because with beer, when you think of the body of beer and the tanginess that these beers can have, and some of them even have a fruity undertone, this is great. So I guess the key here would be, and I think Michael would approve of my saying this, you want beers that have big distinctive flavors, and then you play with other flavorings with big distinctive flavors. Great call. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Anil on the line. Anil, what's on your mind? What would you like to discuss?
Well, I do a lot of Indian cooking because I'm an Indian.
This is a good reason.
That's a very good reason. And my mother was an excellent cook. In fact, she's the basis of my question. When I moved out of India, Indian ingredients weren't that easy to find. And one of the essential ingredients in Indian cooking is mustard seed. And when I lived in England, the mustard seed that was available there was yellow mustard seed. And when you drop them in hot oil, they pop and they do turn black. I was back in India some time ago, and my mother said, you never use yellow mustard seed when you're cooking. You only use the black or the brown mustard seed.
Right.
Now, I have since, the ingredients are much more readily available, and I do make a point of having black mustard seed and larder. But I just was curious to know, what is the difference between yellow mustard seed and black mustard seed?
Essentially, the yellow mustard seed has a more gentle flavor. And I have this, a mustard expert I am not, but I have a sneaking suspicion that there are quite a few different kinds of mustard, therefore quite a few different types of mustard seed in each color. Because I don't know if it's my imagination, but whenever I do that trick, which you grew up with, of you put them in hot oil, you put that dark mustard seed from India in hot oil, and it pops, and then you put that on top of, finish a dish with that.
That's right.
I'm just convinced it has more flavor and more character than the dark brown mustard seeds I might get that might either be domestic or coming from another source. I'm not sure if it's my imagination, but the real difference is that yellow mustard seeds, which make yellow mustard, and if you think about it, you know,
it's
a milder, gentler flavor. Dark mustard seeds, the very dark brown, dark red, black, are generally much richer. They have a bitterness if you taste them untoasted.
Absolutely, yes.
And people like that bitterness.
Yep.
And then, you know, when you toast them, they get this rich, really complex, assertive flavor.
Yeah.
I love the crunch of them. I just, you know, toasting them in that hot oil is just, to
right,
me...
Right, and then putting them on top of any dish, that really makes a difference.
It really does. It really does. So, I think your mom perhaps had a point, and I would never debate with your mother.
No, I wouldn't either.
Considering, let's see now, she has, and you have behind you, what, 3,000 years of some of the most complex, interesting
something
cooking
like
around? Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm not arguing.
Yeah, the only problem is she never left any of her recipes because they were all in her head.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
We're going to have a lot of people popping mustard seeds out there.
Okay, right.
Goodbye.
Bye.
What Anil is talking about, by the way, is it's this trick that is used in Indian cooking to finish off a dish. So you have a curry, you have a salad, and you can do this with anything. You can do this trick for sliced potatoes or for raw foods, for green beans, for meats, for fish. You take a small skillet. You just film the bottom of it with oil, and you add a tablespoon or two of dark mustard seeds. You get the oil kind of hot. It shouldn't be smoking, but it kind of looks a little wavy. And you drop in those mustard seeds, and you better put a lid on it very quickly, because what's going to happen is they're going to get hot, and they start to pop, and you want to keep them in the pan. And as soon as they pop for about 3 or 4 seconds, pull that pan off the heat, and then you can either leave it to room temperature, or you can right away put that hot oil with the seeds over the dish. Ah! Out of this world. Add that to just normal potato salad. See what you think. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. All right, let's see. Who's been waiting patiently? We've got Tricia calling. Tricia, hi, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm a long way from any real mozzarella cheese. Only the Polio is available.
Uh-huh.
And I'm fresh out of Buffalo. So I'm wondering if there's a way to make mozzarella.
There is. I have never tried it myself. I've seen it made. The thing about it is that it starts, by the way, the short answer to your question is I don't know how to make it.
Right.
I've seen it made. And you should certainly be able to make it yourself. But I'll tell you one thing. A lot of people who produce fresh mozzarella, you know, shops and that kind of thing around the country, buy curds from Polio.
And oh,
then
do.
Yeah, and then they do the stretching. Let me explain what the process is.
Okay.
You take milk and you add some kind of culture or acid to it to separate the solids from the liquid, which is the curd from the whey.
Yes.
And you do that by applying heat. And you bring up that heat to the point where the curds get kind of hard. You drain them and you press them, so you really have this sort of dry mass of cheese. And I mean, it's fresh.
It's like farmer's cheese.
Well, yeah, it's even drier. It's squeaky
okay.
when you bite into it. And then what you do is you shred that, and then you have a pot of water that's just below the boil, but you can see steam. And you put that shredded cheese in there, and you start to stir it with a big wooden spoon.
Oh.
And you start stretching it. And you're pulling it, you're just lifting it, and as you lift it, it's going to form these ropes almost. And you do that for just a few moments until you get a nice elasticity. And then what they do is they just break off pieces, and they'll make a ball, they'll make a braid, and then it goes into just a water solution, you know, to sit. And that's what you're buying in the store when you buy it, you know, in tubs with liquid. And sometimes there's salt in that water and sometimes not. So that's
right.
The process. Now, though you could take milk and add some, you know, like add a quarter of a cup of lemon juice to
it. I was going to say lemon juice until it
Well, you heat
curdles.
It. Gradually heat it to about 180 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And you may want to start out with a gallon of milk because it takes a lot of milk to make cheese.
Okay.
And you heat it up. I mean, a culture is probably better, but that's more complicated. And you heat it up. And at 180 degrees, it's going to start to separate. Okay. Hold it at 180 for about 15 minutes. And then let it sit for another 15 minutes and then drain it in a colander and then press out everything you can, stick it in the fridge overnight and then do the shredding and then try the you know, the stretching.
That
if nothing
great.
Else,
I
you're
think
gonna,
I can manage it.
You not only that, but it's a great thing to do with kids.
And
then you call and you tell us what happened.
I'll do it. I've lived in New York City for 21 years. Just walking distance from Joe's Dairy.
Oh gosh, that's one of the great places down right off of Houston Street, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, for anybody going to New York, it's called Joe's. It's off of Houston Street. Look it up in the phone book.
Oh, it's fabulous.
They're making mozzarella in the back room.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, so, Trish, thanks for a great question.
Well, my pleasure, and thanks for a wonderful show.
Well, thank you, dear. Take care. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Sarah waiting patiently. Sarah?
Yeah.
What pressing issue do you want to address?
Well, I have a recipe for black cake, Jamaican black cake.
Yeah.
Which I got from Lori Colwyn's Home Cooking.
Oh, she was such a wonderful writer.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, absolutely
anyway,
great writer.
And I fell in love with this recipe because the way she describes it is just hilarious. At any rate, it's a really satisfying recipe. It takes 4 months. You soak.
It's like, isn't it like a fruitcake?
Yeah, it's a fruitcake.
That's what I thought I remembered.
And what I love about it is you chop up, I don't love the chopping up part, but you chop up 4 pounds of dried fruit and soak them in a bottle of rum and a bottle of port for like up to 4 months. And let me tell you, the day you make the cake, is like the kitchen is like, oh my. But the problem is, the recipe in the book, and I'm sure that this is an editing error,
yeah.
says cook it at 350 in like a 10-inch springform pan
yeah.
for an hour and 15 minutes. Well, it's still liquid at that point.
Yeah.
And so I've left it in for as long as like 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And I stick a, you know, I've looked in every book I can find about fruitcakes and,
mm-hmm.
you know, how you tell when they're done.
Right.
It's, you know, a toothpick has never, ever come out clean.
Yeah.
There's always something sticking to it. And I'm like, How long is too? I mean, is it possible to overbake something like this? Is it, when is it too moist?
I think it is. It's possible only when it's going to, you know, turn to stone because you've got so much moisture in the fruits. But you know what I'm wondering? Do you have a thermometer in your oven? Your oven might be off.
Well, I don't think it is. I do have a thermometer.
You do? Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
It's now. It was 350. You said.
Yeah.
And it's a 10-inch spring form.
Well, there's two 10-inch. It makes. Yeah.
What's just vaguely the proportion of fruit to dry ingredients?
It's like a pound of flour and two
Which
pounds
is four
of
cups.
Sugar, 4 pounds of fruit.
Yeah.
Two
All right.
fifths of alcohol.
Which you drain off.
No, actually, I never have.
Oh, that's the problem.
Okay.
Drain off the alcohol. That's okay. That's okay. Hey, if you added a ton of eggs, you would have a pudding that would be just killer.
Well, but, it is. I mean, I do. I mean, it does have that sort of feel to it, and it has a dozen eggs in it.
Oh, my goodness. I love this. I remember this recipe very, very vaguely. All right, here's the thing. Drain all the alcohol off, because the fruits, after all that soaking, have absorbed
right.
plenty of it. You've got too much liquid in it. That's
right,
the deal.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I think it should work.
Okay.
And
all right,
in the meantime,
so
if anything that you have left over that's a mistake, you tell people it's meant to be that way.
Oh, I mean, actually, people love this. Like, my parents every year go, are you going to do the black cake?
This is the drinkable cake, and it tastes so good. We all love it.
Really, exactly.
Hey, Sarah, right. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You see, recipes don't tell you everything sometimes that you need to know, and I really mean that. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Peter Pierbright. Potatoes, like wives, should never be taken for granted. Everything you heard here and more can be found on our website. That's splendidtable.org. Let me tell you, that website has a life of its own. It has a forum. It has a store. It even has its own show called Tuesday Night Kitchen. It's your web guide to feeding the people you care about. Check it out. There's a new show every Tuesday. This week, we're going to be talking about lentils. Again, the address is splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift, with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Rice Challah piece was produced by Eve Tro. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week, and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.